From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. State legislators send a death penalty repeal bill to the governor, who has promised to veto it. A bill that merges the definitions of domicile and residency for voting purposes advances, and a paid family and medical leave bill gets sent to interim study. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we will talk about them in this hour. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. That is all one word. And we are streaming a live video of this radio show as we do every Friday morning, so it is very easy to listen and watch. You can check out the stream at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor, and Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader. Gentlemen, welcome.
Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
So the phone number again for you to call and join the conversation, 1-800-892-6477. A lot of legislative news to talk about this week. So let's start by talking about the death penalty repeal. The lawmakers passed a bill that would strike the words "may be punished by death" from the state's capital punishment statute that would end the death penalty in New Hampshire. Ethan, you reported on this for the Concord Monitor. What is the significance of this moment?
Well, so this is the first time in a while that both chambers have voted for this. The more significant vote actually was the Senate vote. They've deadlocked in recent years on this issue, 12-12. And so this year, since 2000, is the first time that a death penalty repeal bill has made it to the governor's desk.
Mm-hmm. And the governor promising to veto it, so people aren't really terribly hopeful for this.
No. The governor stated way back in February before the Senate vote his intentions to veto it, and that's similar along the lines of then-Governor Jeanne Shaheen, who also promised that in 2000.
Though the governor's promised veto hasn't stopped lawmakers from arguing their positions on it, State Representative Rennie Cushing, whose father was murdered in 1988, believes the death penalty is not consistent with the values of the state.
New Hampshire has never been in love with the death penalty. New Hampshire values civil liberties, it values human rights. New Hampshire can live without the death penalty.
New Hampshire can live without the death penalty, according to State Rep. Rennie Cushing.
Well, Kevin. Certainly New Hampshire has lived without it since 1939. That's the last time we put someone to death. I think that's one of the reasons why this debate, unlike in other states, politically has failed to gain traction because it hasn't been before the public consciousness. And it's only recently since the murder of Manchester patrolman Michael Briggs by Michael Addison, who now is on our so-called death row, he becomes the first person who would be put to death. That's a controversy with this law as well. The law, the bill as written specifically says this wouldn't apply to Addison, but the Attorney General has essentially said no state has done that before. No state has ever put someone to death after that state has repealed its death penalty law.
Dean?
Yeah, this vote for repeal for repeal the death penalty mirrors what's going on around the country, has been going on for a number of years now. A big debate over concerns surrounding cost, accuracy, whether or not people being put to death are in fact guilty of the crimes they've been convicted of. There's been a lot of advances in DNA testing that has helped get some people out of jail who had been on death row. Questions about whether or not it really acts as a deterrent. And what's really interesting to me about this particular vote is it gives you a sense about how much the debate has changed, that you have an all-Republican-controlled state legislature voting in favor of repeal. Traditionally, the death penalty has been viewed by Republicans as a law and order issue, as an issue about deterrence, as an issue about justice. There has been some overlap in the past among religious conservatives who have opposed the death penalty on religious grounds. But the fact that you would have a Republican-controlled legislature vote in favor of repeal shows you how much the debate over the death penalty has changed. And as Kevin mentioned, within the state in particular, there are just a lot of logistical questions about the cost, millions of dollars to build a death chamber. We haven't done this in many, many years, as Kevin mentioned. So I guess I'm not surprised to see the legislature move this way. Clearly, Governor Sununu is reflecting a more traditional Republican opposition to repealing the death penalty.
Yeah, and his position is more consistent with being governor, right? I mean, law enforcement is very much against this, and law enforcement has convinced every person who's been New Hampshire governor since I've been covering politics for over 30 years to oppose repeal of the death penalty. One of the things that did change here was, interestingly enough, when Senator Maggie Hassan was State Senator Maggie Hassan, she supported the creation of a commission, Dean will recall, that this commission was very divided on whether to repeal the death penalty, but it kind of universally supplied a lot of data which suggested you really don't save any money by having a death penalty. And Dean's point, the first time you execute someone, you're spending millions and millions of dollars. But in addition to that, with all the appeals and the exhaustive litigation that's required to put somebody to death, it's actually not a money saver.
And you think about the additional problems that states have had in actually carrying out executions,
right.
All the problems about lethal injection and concerns about the types of drugs and cruel and unusual punishment. It's just it just feels to me like a very different debate now than, say, 10 or 20 years ago.
And Dean, you mentioned the DNA testing.
Yeah.
Hearing legislators and committees and on the floor, that seemed to be a major factor in this shift, at least in New Hampshire. A lot of people who changed their votes, especially in the Senate, cited meeting some of the exonerated people and talking about their stories and that being a big factor in their decision to support repeal.
A lot of legislative news to get to this week. We're going to talk about Marcy's Law. We're going to be talking about paid family and medical leave, the difference between domicile and residency, and a bill that would merge those two. Also, a tax break for companies that are in the Oregon manufacturing business. That's all coming up on the roundup. If you'd like to weigh in on the conversation about the week's news, the number to call is 1-800-892-6477. A proposed constitutional amendment that would have enshrined victims' rights in the state's constitution was defeated this week. Kevin Landrigan, you've been paying attention to this. How did that go down?
Well, it was pretty overwhelming in the House, just as overwhelming as the support was in the Senate. What was interesting about this constitutional amendment was what you see in Concord often in the New Hampshire House, which, as we know, is a very representative body, in quotes, I mean, with so many members. This large body often looks at a proposition brought to it by when it has the support of both political parties and the governor and becomes very skeptical about it in response. They figure there must be something else going on here if everybody says we have to do this. And the House, two committees really picked this proposal apart piece by piece, suggesting we've already got a victim's rights statute. Why do we need an amendment? Once we put an amendment in, how do we change that amendment? Do we really want to do this in terms of prior to the conviction of someone, make somebody a victim when they may not actually be a victim? And what about the cost to cities and towns and counties to prosecute and provide services for all these victims? So it sort of died of a thousand cuts on the House floor. At least it looked that way to me. I was following the debate online.
Yeah, what's so interesting to me is, you know, this is something that has there's been a movement for Marcy's Law around the country. It's being funded by a California billionaire who lost a family member. So there was a lot of national support behind this here in New Hampshire, rallies, et cetera, political organizing. And it moved very quickly through the Senate. And this is something that I had not been particularly aware of Marcy's Law as it played out in other parts of the country. And what I saw here as I keyed into this issue in New Hampshire is little by little, as Kevin said, you know, the former Justice Conaboy spoke against it, and a number of other legal scholars have come out. And I think gradually people have come to understand some of the potential unintended consequences of passing this. And I think that's what people in the House were keying in on. But I also like the kind of what you're suggesting, the sort of contrarian nature of the House in the sense that this is rushing through. Let's stop a minute and take a look. But I do think part of it is just a process of people learning about what this is and coming to understand what initially seemed like pretty sort of difficult legal arguments. And now, as it's been explained, I think there's more concern.
Yeah, to Kevin's point about kind of just the differing philosophies in both chambers, perhaps, when you watch it on the Senate floor proceed, the attitude from the Senate was, this is important. It was supported by the governor, but we want to tweak it. But nobody wants to not pass the Marcy's Law. There were a flurry of amendments. Most of them got struck down, and then it had a near unanimous vote. And then when it got to the House, the attitude was more, why do we need this? And let's start from that starting point. And why do we need this constitutional amendment? And then all the arguments kind of fit into that mold. And slowly, the Joint Committee, as Kevin said, kind of death by a thousand cuts, chipped away in their minds at each of the reasons why this should replace the current statutory rights for victims.
I also felt like trying to accomplish such a sweeping change like this in an election year, which when you have sort of a shortened legislative session and very, as Ethan is there, he knows this, a very stressed out membership, it's very hard to pass something this complex in a year. In a year like this, when a lot of legislators just want to get home to their campaigns.
Mm-hmm. And apparently there was a measure taken to prevent this from coming up again this session. Is that why, Kevin? Because it's just too hard to do it this year?
Well, that's essentially a message the House is fond of making. The Senate occasionally does, but the House likes to make it to essentially say, and don't come back next year. They're basically trying to say to supporters of Marcy's Law, who are already saying, we're not going anywhere, we're coming back next year, that you're going to have a very difficult time getting this through the legislature next year. Will be a new legislature, and they can bring in a new amendment in 2019.
There had been, about $2 million in planned advertisements. This was going to be, obviously, a campaign. It's a constitutional amendment. So if it passed the House and was signed by the governor, it would then go to the people. And I think I heard from legislators yesterday that the idea of cutting off reconsideration was to kind of stop any effort by some of the outside lobbyists from keeping it alive. For legislators, they wanted to kind of just end it for good for this year.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. And coming up on the show, 2020 presidential candidate Andrew Yang stopped by New Hampshire with his pitch for a universal basic income. He says people of a certain age should get $1,000 a month from the government. What do you think about the idea of universal basic income? Is it too expensive, or is it a good way to correct the problems caused by jobs lost to automation, as Andrew Yang argues? The number for you to call to weigh in on universal basic income, 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. We'd love to bring your questions or comments into that part of the conversation when it starts. Give us a call. Right now, we're going to talk about paid family and medical leave. That was also in the news this week. Maybe at least two stories we'll talk about this week that involves sending a bill to die a quiet death in interim study. Dean, this is kind of a way that lawmakers use to sort of say thanks but no thanks. But
yeah, sometimes it's a way to get it off the agenda. Sometimes it's a way to say legitimately there needs to be more work on it. I think Kevin suggested the dynamic of we're late in the session and if people are not happy with it, they're just not ready to move on it. And this is a bill that has been pushed very hard by Democrat Senator Dan Feltes has been a big proponent of this. I remember back in the 2016 election, this was one of the issues on which Democrats and Republicans said they could potentially agree. But as it always turns out, the devil is in the details, and Governor Sununu has been increasingly vocal about being unhappy about the potential cost of this and whether or not this is something that where the state will essentially get stuck paying for insurance program for family leave.
Though the supporters were kind of disappointed in Governor Sununu, in part because he said he was supportive in general of an idea
right.
like
yeah.
this.
Well, that's what he said in the campaign. Right, and he said that in the campaign. I just think there's been tremendous debate about how much it's actually going to cost, who should bear that burden, whether it should be a function of private insurance or state-subsidized insurance. But this has been a hot issue around the country for a few years now. And if you pay attention to kind of the political discourse in the state, a tremendous amount of energy expended on this over the past year. And it seems like, at least for now, they've hit a bit of a hiccup on it.
One thing to say, I mean, the one thing to understand about what happened with this bill is New Hampshire is creating a program that there are five states right now that have a statewide paid family leave insurance program. All five of those have a mandatory program. And that's because in insurance, when you make something mandatory, you have a much larger pool to
spread out the risk around, right?
Right. And so New Hampshire, that's not very palatable. That would effectively amount to an income tax because if everybody had to participate and everybody had to pay premiums out of their wages, that's what's the difference. So New Hampshire, both the governor's version and the Democrats' version, both had voluntary visions. That creates a lot of trouble if you create any kind of voluntary insurance program, especially in a small state like New Hampshire, it creates a lot of trouble in in predicting how it will do. And so that kind of uncertainty was capitalized by the governor and by Republicans to say that we don't know how much this will cost. If this were mandatory and every employee in New Hampshire had to participate, you would have a much clearer idea of costs. But the
And there also had been some discussion about among Republicans about perhaps having employers purchase private insurance, and there's not a real big insurance market for this kind of thing right now. So there's just a lot of disagreement still on you know, mandatory, voluntary, who bears the cost, how much would the state be liable for down the road?
Yeah, but one more thing about this worth mentioning was the whole sticky note episode that was in, I think it was in the Union Leader, maybe it was in the Concord Monitor as well. Ethan, you're nodding, so you recall this incident?
Yes.
So it has to do with the solvency of the program where there were changes and And the government agency said, yeah, with these changes, it's solvent.
So this is it's complex. So it depends on who you talk to. Basically, in the last 2 weeks, let's set the stage. The last 2 weeks, the Department of Employment Security, which is would be charged with creating this, setting up this program, creating it and running it, and the Department of Insurance have both said, we can't guarantee the solvency. Democrats have now said, wait a second, at a committee hearing that were provided to Democrats a few months ago, the Department of Employment Security advocated for changes to the program by increasing the premium that employees would have and cutting the benefit from 12 weeks to 6. And they produced a document with a sticky note that they said was written by one of the governor's advisors that said that this program will be solvent. I haven't been able to verify the authenticity of that sticky note or the authenticity of this document. I've seen a photo of it. But suffice to say, in the last 2 weeks, the Department of Employment Security has changed its whatever its position was before. It is now its position is now we can't guarantee the solvency, and Democrats say that's a flip flop.
Ah, all right. Well, that's a right to know request in the making, right? Please turn over all your sticky notes. last story we should talk about before the break, and that's it's a big story. We're not going to give it too much time today, but it is a big story. The bill merging the definitions of domicile and residency. Ethan, you were writing about this for the Concord Monitor, and it advanced this week at least a little bit.
Yes, it advanced on party lines. It'll move to the Senate floor. What's interesting here is there's actually been two bills. One of them had a lengthy purpose clause in the beginning, which effectively kind of sets the, it doesn't have legal effect, but it does set the stage. And the Senate added that. The House didn't like that. But basically, the point of both bills is to standardize the different definitions of domicile and resident in the eyes of in voting law and other law in New Hampshire.
Which may have implications for people who have just moved here or college students who live in dormitories.
Yes. So Democrats argue that by changing this definition, if you go to the polls, you were presumed to be a domiciled person, which is different than a resident. A resident has to register their car within 60 days of becoming a resident, has to get a driver's license, et cetera. So now by going to the polls, you are now effectively declaring yourself a resident and will now have to pay for registration fees, which Democrats say amount to a poll tax. Republicans say if you're going to live here and act as a resident in every other way, then paying car registration fees and getting a driver's license is just a natural result of that, and it's not related directly to voting.
And really quickly, Ethan, so there are two bills that are very similar. If one bill sort of fails, do lawmakers essentially get another bite at the apple with the other one?
Yes, essentially that's what it is. And one of them has gone to the Committee of Conference, so we'll see which one prevails in the end. We don't know what the governor is going to do to support it.
Okay, well, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We're speaking with Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor, Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader, and Dean Spiliotis of SNHU. And with you, we hope, give us a call. We're going to be talking about universal basic income within the next 20 minutes or so. We want you to be a part of that conversation when it starts. What do you think of universal basic income? We had one 2020 presidential candidate already come to New Hampshire pitching this idea. The number to call is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org and watch our live streaming video at our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
Spring is just about here, and Morning Edition is hitting the road. In our new weekly series, we're traveling across the Granite State to take you to new places and introduce you to new people.
Yeah, the moon looks very cinematic. What are we expecting to see tonight?
Yeah, people come here to see the alpacas.
Homebrewers starting out, how do you get from just whipping up batches in your basement to opening up your own tasting room?
Listen to Radio Field Trips, Morning Edition's new series about New Hampshire life and culture, Wednesday mornings from 5 to 9 on NHPR.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we're speaking with our guests today about the week's news. We've got Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader, Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, here in the studio. Happy to answer your questions if you have them. It's been a busy week in the news this week. And if you have questions, now's the time to call and ask. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Clarifying one remark that we made just before the break regarding the bill that would merge the definitions of domicile and residency. Governor Kevin has concerns about it, not necessarily opposed to it, but says he has concerns.
Yeah, as Ethan pointed out before the break, the governor has he's been kind of general on this proposal, and he's never endorsed either of these ideas. He has said he has concerns about them, to be sure, and doesn't support them in their current form. It's the basic iteration right now. I mean, that's what's allowed Republican legislative leaders in both the House and Senate to consider continue pursuing this cause in the hopes that they can come up with language that he can ultimately support.
Yeah, he didn't necessarily say that he was going to veto it, but they
exactly.
did reiterate their statement this right. week that he does not support either bill in the current form. And it was interesting to see Democratic activists tweeting him and thanking him for saying that.
Right.
Okay. Lots of other things to discuss this week. Among them, we've been talking about interim study. Here's another one that went to interim study. The controversial school choice bill, the House Finance Committee voted 14-12 to send it to study. And that essentially takes it off the table for the rest of the year. But Ethan, tell us about this bill. What would it have done?
So this bill, for the recommendation, I should just say to start, is for interim study. That can be overturned. It often is on the House floor. So this is by no means a done deal. But basically the idea is to create a quasi-voucher system by using state adequacy funds, which track to pupils in public schools, and allowing parents who want to take their child out of a public school to use those public funds for use at a private school or institution. And so this has had kind of a long journey. It's gone through a lot of changes. Its final version that kind of went through the finance subcommittees and through the finance committee last week has a lot of restrictions based on the earliest version. There's now an income cap of 185% of the income level. There's some percentage caps on because there have been concerns over how many, if there was a large exodus of students leaving public schools, that the public schools would lose that money. So now there are percentage caps per district. And yet the Finance Committee last week on a close vote, I believe it was a 14-12 vote, voted to interim study. It said that there were too many concerns with how this might affect districts, and some members were opposed to the idea of using public school funds for private education in general.
So, Kevin, is this another example of this legislation is simply just too much of a hot potato in an election year and let's go study it?
There's some of that. I think there's also just some institutional opposition in the House, and it has been for a long time, about using public dollars to support religious education. I mean, Neil Kirk, who's chairman of the House Finance Committee, has been a longtime opponent of that proposition. And there are a lot of conservatives in the House who feel that way. This is a signature issue for Governor Chris Sununu. He really wants this to happen, and he by no means is giving up, and I'm sure it's going to lean heavily on Republicans in the House to support it in some form so that they can at least get some kind of bill to a conference committee and try and work this thing out.
Well, let's hear what Republican Neil Kirk had to say about this. He was among the majority who voted to send it to interim study, to recommend to send it to interim study, which would essentially take it off the table for the rest of the year.
I've voted in favor of choice in the past, but I can't support this bill for one reason, or one primary reason. This bill downshifts $99 million to local property taxpayers in ways that they will not be able to avoid by reducing expenses.
So he's concerned about costs.
Yeah, the cost has been a big issue, and the impact on particularly some of the larger public schools in the state. And the other issue that you mentioned was the issue of there's been a debate about whether or not this bill should include religious institutions as part of the program for students who'd be able to use those dollars to go to a religious school. That's the kind of thing that is traditionally challenged in court on constitutional grounds. I think our AG had initially expressed some concerns, and then later on said that no, they thought that it could withstand constitutional muster. These sort of voucher, as Ethan said, quasi voucher programs have been very have been very there's been a lot of conflict about whether or not they're constitutional around the country. And so my guess is if at some point it does pass, it would end up in the courts anyway.
And Ethan, is there a chance that it might come out of study?
Well, I mean, again, these interim study recommendations are often overturned. They're not always. It's entirely unpredictable. I think the House has been unpredictable. But one thing I want to add, beyond just religious schools, there have been concerns over schools not providing services for people with disabilities, and there being nothing in the law that requires these private institutions to do that.
As public schools are.
Right. And so the advocates have said, well, you know, it's up to each parent. This is a parental choice. If they should be able to take their kid and bring their kid to a school that best fits them. So that would come down to parental choice. And one thing I just wanted to add is that advocates for this say that it's been kind of watered down or narrowed down enough that it's essentially just a pilot program. That's what one of the advocates told me yesterday. And so they dispute the idea that it would have cost impacts, but opponents say the costs are just kind of unknowable.
A pilot program meaning that there are only a certain number of students that can take advantage of this program?
Yeah, under the latest percentage caps per district, apparently that if you do the math, it's something around 500 or something students who are eligible for this. And advocates say there's not going to be anywhere close to 500 who even sign up for it because of all the limitations. So they're saying that this is really just a small-scale program that is just to sort of see how the model works. And so that's what the argument that they're taking to the House floor.
Okay. We're going to stick with the theme of things being sent to interim study for the next story. And that is, I think, one you've been working on, Ethan, which is that the Senate Judiciary Committee recommended to send to interim study a bill that would prevent gender identity discrimination. The vote was along party lines, 3-2. Mm-hmm. Tell us about this bill, Ethan. How would it have prevented this kind of discrimination?
So to give some background, this is a replica bill of a bill that almost made it through the legislature last year. But on a tie-breaking vote that was cast by then Speaker Sean Jasper, was tabled. You normally can't restore a bill that has, already been brought up in a session. But because of the tabling motion, they were allowed to bring it up this year again. So this is a redo essentially, and it's had support so far. This is the first kind of hurdle that it's faced in committee. It fell under party lines. There are three legs this bill. It adds non-discrimination language to New Hampshire's law for people for gender identity, it adds non-discrimination for housing, for employment, and for accommodations. And that last bit, accommodations, has been kind of the sticking point for opponents. The accommodations includes public bathrooms, and so the kind of infamous bathroom debate with transgender individuals has come up. And in the committee, that was what came up. The lawmakers wanted to separate that provision from the whole bill.
Mm-hmm. And so what do you think? Is there a chance that this will defy the recommendation to go to study?
Yeah, there's a good chance, actually, because there are three Republican Senate sponsors that have already sponsored this bill, and then there's expected to be full Democratic support. So supporters say we effectively have the votes on the floor, but that the committee vote is nonetheless disappointing.
Okay. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We've been speaking with our guests today about the week's news, and still to come, the on-again, off-again commuter rail study is now off, and prospects apparently don't look good. Kevin Landrigan here will give us some details on that. But let us know what commuter rail might have meant to you. Do you want rail lines stretching from New Hampshire to the Boston area? Why or why not? How would it affect you? Tell us your story. Or ask questions if you have them. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can also post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. So let's talk about Andrew Yang, early 2020 presidential candidate. He was in New Hampshire this week. Dean, who is this person?
Yeah, he's not somebody who's going to be well known to most voters. He's running for president as a Democrat. He's what you would call sort of a classic long shot. He's a New York entrepreneur. I think he's in his mid-40s. Has developed a number of sort of nonprofit ventures focused on developing entrepreneurship particularly in cities. And he was here on Wednesday touting his universal basic income. He has this idea that all Americans age 18 to 64 should get $1,000 a month, so basically $12,000 a year from the government, to close the wage gap and also to make up for job loss due to automation. So he says, interestingly enough, that he's going to pick one Granite State, or I don't really know the details yet, and give them $1,000 a month for a year to show that it can make a difference. So that may be something that will, you know, we were talking earlier, maybe there'll be a reality show following this individual to see, you know, what kind of impact the money has. But there are all kinds of complications with that idea in terms of campaigns and you know, potentially paying for a vote, et cetera, et cetera. So, and how would you pick that individual? He's a Phillips Exeter grad. That's his connection to New Hampshire. He's a Columbia Law JD. You know, we'll see. There, you know, as anybody who's voted in the New Hampshire primary knows, you often have 25 to 30 candidates on each ballot. So he'll be in the mix, you know, we'll see whether he ends up becoming a you know, serious candidate or sort of a kind of a marginal curiosity based on this idea, which, yeah, it's the U.S. can barely keep Social Security solvent for people over 65. Now we're talking about a basically 18 and up, you know, a guaranteed income.
Ethan?
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of expand a little bit on universal basic income. This is sort of a fringe economic proposal, usually favored on the left. And the idea is, just to expand on a little bit what Dean said, is that with automation kind of replacing, you know, factory jobs, automation can, with factories, the theory goes, it can boost the economy, but it doesn't help workers. And so the idea is, as the country gets richer, the workers suffer, you know, some of the working class people will suffer. And so by taking that money and kind of redistributing it with payments, this is a way to balance the system and keep the economy going. Obviously, it can be very easily construed to be socialism or kind of something along those lines, and that's sort of where the opposition comes from. And it looks like Andrew Yang is sort of using this as a single issue platform. So it'll be interesting to see how that takes in a primary campaign in New Hampshire.
Yes.
Just a second, Kevin. Yep. Kevin, you chuckled a little bit when Ethan said favored mostly on the left.
Yeah, I don't think there's a conservative view about handing out $1,000 a month checks to everyone between the age of 18 to 64. But Ethan's right. I mean, that's what presidential campaigns are for, and that's why candidates love New Hampshire. They get to, it's kind of the laboratory of ideas up here, and he's got a new concept, and he certainly is expressing a view many people feel, is that automation is making it harder and harder for working class people to eke out a very good living in the future.
It's a more generic version of the pony for everybody idea from Vernon Supreme. Yeah, it's just a more evolved
chicken
version.
In every pot.
Right. Right.
Well, we get a question from Mike who asked, and I don't know if you know the answer to this, gentleman, but which countries, if any, have implemented universal basic income? Shaking heads around the table, so I guess not.
I'm not familiar.
Yeah, and so the follow-up questions seem to be irrelevant. How would they compare demographically to the U.S.? What's the impact on wages, inflation, poverty levels, and employment?
So I have heard occasionally in recent years about some towns, in particular in Europe, offering small towns offering, you know, people guaranteed income to move and populate the community. So that's a kind of a micro version of this. But Ethan sort of referred to it as a single party, a single issue candidate. That's typically the realm of third party politics. So who knows? He may end up in the end running as a third party candidate.
And just one thing about I was reading up on the choice of $1,000 a month. So within this idea of universal basic income, the arguments against it are often, though, this will discourage people from finding jobs. You're basically just giving them money, and they're not going to innovate, and they're not going to participate in the economy, and the workforce will come to a standstill. So he stated that he chose $1,000 because it's not enough to discourage people from working. $12,000 a year is, you know, not very much to live off. And so the idea is that it's low enough that you would still want to be, you know, find employment, but you wouldn't necessarily be trapped in some cycle. That's how he would describe it.
Well, one of the arguments I've heard against universal basic income is that if you give everybody the same baseline, the cost of living is going to increase in whatever area has that universal basic income, which would eventually negate the benefit of the UBI, which makes me a little bit skeptical of how realistic we could see this experiment because if it's just one person, it's not like the rents in the town this person is living in is going to go up to accommodate, which would be that criticism. So essentially giving it to one person would insulate this experiment from that particular criticism.
And as Dean put it, I mean, it raises a lot of questions in terms of how you run a campaign that is paying a person $1,000 a month. I mean, not just from kind of, you know, campaign finance questions, but also just sort of strategically, how do you kind of spotlight that person? How do they really factor into your campaign? Who is this person going to be? Are they going to be a public person in the campaign? I mean, how is this exactly going to roll out with just one?
Yeah, well, actually, it might be two. One in Iowa as well.
Oh.
Iowa, of course. Yeah, so, I mean, this is interesting. It's in, we talked a little bit, I think I heard over the cubicle walls here at NHPR, that this may not be a favored practice among those in state government simply because it has the whiff of paying someone for a vote, although that's not exactly what Andrew Yang is claiming to want to do here. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We're going to be talking about the week's news for the rest of the hour. And if you've got questions, give us a call. Really quickly, Kevin Landrigan, you've been reporting on the on-again, off-again study of commuter rail, this $4 million study. It's been on and off. It's been kind of a political football. But where does it stand now?
Yeah, the Senate Transportation Committee recently voted to take the money back out of the 10-year plan. It was put into the 10-year plan on the floor of the House by the membership. The Republican leadership in both the House and the Senate don't support this idea now that Governor Sununu is no longer a big cheerleader for it. Folks may recall Sununu changed his mind about commuter rail in order to try and attract Amazon to come to New Hampshire. Once Amazon said, New Hampshire, you're not on the list, the governor lost a lot of interest in pursuing that proposal, but there still remains a lot of support among rank and file. But the Senate committee has taken out. I mean, this subject is much like many we're talking about in this hour, which is it's important to remember in any legislative session, nothing's dead until the year ends. For example, the 10-year highway plan is going to go to a conference committee. So even if the Senate takes the commuter rail money out, you go to the conference committee and it's in the House version of the bill. So it's going to be subject to debate until the end of the session and they figure out how to reconcile what that 10-year plan should be.
Let's get a call before the break. Andrew is calling from Peterborough. Andrew, thank you very much for calling in. What's your question or comment?
Well, thank you for taking my call. My comment is that I would think it would be very intelligent for the state of New Hampshire to reinstate or reestablish a passenger rail. We're the only state in New England that does not have, I believe, passenger rail to any our capital or any large cities. Portsmouth, it goes through Durham, not down Portsmouth, downtown Portsmouth. And I think it would be a great boost to the economy. It would help encourage younger workers to want to work in New Hampshire, maybe commute to New Hampshire, and also would facilitate commuting to larger cities like Boston or Connecticut cities in Connecticut or Massachusetts. And it would also minimize the expense that we keep on spending on expanding our roads at some point, which will be impossible to do. We keep on making two lanes, four lanes, and six lanes. At some point, we need to put the passengers back on the rail and get them out of the cars and stop the expense of building highways.
Well, Andrew, thank you very much for your comment. Yeah, the arguments Andrew seemed to be making there were arguments we've heard every time this is actually in play, this commuter rail study. Andrew, thanks very much for the call. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Still to come, we'll talk about union contracts. They're making some progress. We'll also talk about other things in the news. Uncompensated care. Ethan DeWitt has been covering this for the Concord Monitor. We'll get the latest on that. If you have questions about the week's news, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Also, if you are interested, we are streaming a live video of this radio show on our Facebook page. Check it out at NHPR Exchange. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and the author of the website NH Political Capital, Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor, and Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader. And with you, we hope, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Love hearing from listeners. Your questions or comments really do enrich the conversation. A few more stories to talk about before the end of the hour. This week, negotiators with the four unions representing public employees reached tentative contract agreements with the state of New Hampshire. This This has been a long time coming. Kevin, why did it take so long to get here?
Well, certainly you have Governor Chris Sununu, who was not supported or endorsed in his campaign in 2016 by any of these unions, that not only didn't support him, but spent millions of dollars supporting his Democratic opponent, Colin Van Arsten. Suffice to say, that put negotiations on the wrong foot to begin with. Then the governor, looking at the history of state employee contracts, felt they'd been getting consistent raises over the last several, and meanwhile had a very lucrative health care insurance package. So he wanted changes in insurance in order to support any increase in pay for these state workers. Ultimately, this went to a fact finder, and the fact finder's report, I think, kind of broke the logjam. Interestingly enough, we're supposed to see later today what was in that fact finder's report. Because once that came out, both sides sort of went to the middle. The governor initially didn't support any increase. The unions were asking for 3%. We ended up with 1.5% increase in the first year, 1.5% increase in the second year, much larger increase for corrections officers at the state prison, a 9% increase there. And in return, employees are committing to some kind of unspecified changes in sick and bonus leave, which would reduce some of the administrative costs for this program.
And so what remains to be done on this?
Well, so it needs approval both by each union has different rules, but by union membership, and it also needs to be approved by the legislature. Overall, these contracts are $13.5 million, so that'll have to be agreed to by the legislature. And each union has its own process. The State Employees Association, which covers a vast range of employees in the state, as I understand it, they had a bargaining senate, which is made up of local leadership of unions, that was meeting on Thursday. And so they have to approve it before it can go to their members for a vote. So there are a lot of steps, basically. And the key word here is tentative. I was told by representatives that there were still some last-minute negotiations on Monday that were still being hammered out. We'll see if they have been hammered out.
All right. Story is not over yet. The key word, as you say, is tentative, so we'll stay on this. Another piece of legislation this week, the House passed a bill that would give a 10-year tax break to businesses that focus on generating human organs. The measure comes after inventor Dean Kamen and the city of Manchester were chosen for an $80 million federal grant focused on growing tissues and organs from a person's own cells. Here's Representative Bill Ohm of Nashua.
The semiconductor industry transformed orange groves into Silicon Valley. Let's have regenerative manufacturing transform our mills into medical miracles.
Mills into medical miracles. That seems to be, I guess, the prevailing sentiment in the House, that this is a good thing for Manchester, even though New Hampshire legislators typically don't provide tax breaks to particular companies or industries at large. Dean?
Yeah, this has been developing for a few years now, this idea that Manchester and the mill yard in particular, starting with Dean Kamen's work with that big contract of tissue regeneration, advanced regenerative medicine, that you could really build a sort of biomedical version of Silicon Valley in and around Manchester by having a lot of these companies start to either spin off or come here and set up shop. And as you mentioned, when we were talking about possibly luring the second Amazon headquarters here several months ago, and we ended up getting cut from the list of finalists. There had been a lot of talk about how New Hampshire would have difficulty competing because the legislature does not typically offer a lot of tax breaks to companies in a way that other states are stepping over each other to offer Amazon tax breaks. So that's kind of an interesting question here, but it would be a 10-year tax exemption. And I think the excitement here is that there's a potential for this to really become a technology corridor for regenerative medicine.
Kevin?
Yeah, I think a couple of things. One, it sort of speaks to Dean Kamen's profile in New Hampshire. He's the only person who could have possibly pulled this off to this point. I mean, New Hampshire does have this animus against tax credits, and this is a sweeping tax credit. I mean, for 10 years, all the companies that were initially, as it was proposed, you had to be a member of this institute in order to get the tax break. And the House has changed that to merely be someone who's investing in the proposition to receive a 10-year tax break from both state business taxes and a 5-year student loan forgiveness plan for employees who agree to commit to work there for 5 years. Kamen's made the argument to legislators here that he's got companies and universities all over the country that are very interested in having a piece of this pie. And that so that in order to get a lot of investors and small spin-off companies from this institute to locate here in New Hampshire, you have to create some kind of incentive. Ergo this. Attorney General Gordon McDonald has also produced a legal opinion that this is constitutional, even though critics maintain this appears to be essentially a special interest tax break that not all classes of taxpayers are eligible to receive. I submit there are a lot of biotech companies that aren't involved in this project that would love the same kind of tax break, and they're not getting it under this bill.
So is there likely to be legislation filed by them against the state for passing this? Or?
I don't know. I mean, what's interesting is the Attorney General speaks to, in the late 1990s, we created this exemption from the interest and dividends tax in order to get these investment companies to come to the state. And that passed and looks kind of similar, I mean, somewhat special interest or very targeted. It's never been challenged in court. So that I think it's, if this passes, and I suspect it will now, the question will become, will some kind of other institutional player in industry challenge the constitutionality? They might.
Few more stories to discuss this week, among them the evolving story about paying for uncompensated care. Ethan, you've been writing about this for the Concord Monitor. You've been writing about how the state suddenly had to come up with, what was it, $71 million?
Yeah, so the number, it kind of fluctuates.
The number shifts, right? But
there
was a court case that essentially said, actually, New Hampshire, you owe these hospitals a lot more than you thought you would have for uncompensated care, people without insurance or people on Medicaid. And now the state has to figure out a way to get that money, and Senate President Chuck Morse says he has a way.
Yeah, so basically, under Medicaid law, this has been going on since the 80s. There's been something called disproportionate share hospital payments that are paid to hospitals that take in large amounts of uninsured people or people on Medicaid. The idea is that every time hospitals take these people in, they lose money on treating them, and so that they should be made whole or at least reimbursed by the state. But that the way that that has been carried out has long been the subject of debate, particularly since 2011 here in New Hampshire. There's been multiple areas of litigation, and there's been disagreement over how to calculate how to pay those out. So the court ruling that came down in March said that the way New Hampshire budgeted, and it applied nationwide, but it hit New Hampshire and basically kind of said the formula that New Hampshire used to budget last year was short by up to $38 million. And so what the Senate president did this week, hospitals are now saying, because of this court ruling in March, you have until May 31st to pay over the $38 million that you didn't give us before. And Senate President Chuck Morse has now presented a proposal to take that $38 million and put it into escrow pending any further appeals, because this was a district court decision. It is very likely to be appealed to a circuit court. Hospitals are saying that's not how it works. Once a court strikes something down, you have to honor it. If it is changed in appeal, that's one thing. But Morse is arguing that if we give you the money now and the court goes our way in the future, we will have to reclaim that money from the hospitals. And that could really hurt the hospitals if they rely on this money. So he's saying a better solution is to put this into escrow. And this all came to a head this week in a hearing, which at times turned into a shouting match between legislators and the hospitals, who have not exactly proven popular among legislators in recent years. Basically, it's unclear where the state is going to find a solution to this, but they're running out of time. They've only got about a week left to appropriate it through the regular process, and the hospitals have remained firm that they want all the money, and they want it all by May 31st. So it's unclear how it's going to resolve itself.
Yeah, and one of the consequences, as you reported, in putting this money in escrow is that some other legislative priorities may be hit.
Sure. So it's unclear where the money might come from. I mean, right now his proposal is to take it from the general fund. There are projected revenues of, you know, $53 million in business taxes, like extra revenues. So that might be a cushion, but it's sort of some are concerned that this could hit at other bills. And right now, there's just not much known. It's mostly been Senate leadership and the Senate president and the governor and hospitals kind of hammering this out. But there hasn't been much involvement by other legislators, by Democrats, and it's really kind of unclear where these negotiations have gone. All we know is for now they have stalled, and very publicly stalled.
You mentioned that it's going to escrow because there may be appeals. Are there appeals right now? Is New Hampshire involved in it?
So this is the kind of the complication of how the federal court system works. There are multiple layers of lawsuits. There's one on an Obama administration rule that New Hampshire's fighting. There's one on a Trump administration rule that New Hampshire's fighting. The rule that's relevant here came from a D.C. court from a Texas case. But because it applied nationwide, you can compare it to the Hawaii court striking down the immigration ban from the president. One state can affect immigration policy for the whole country, and that's essentially what happened here. So New Hampshire is involved, but basically there's any number of these legal developments could have an effect down the line. What is known is that nothing is going to change between now and May 31st legally. There's no court that's going to rule in between then and now, and so hospitals are saying, because this is the latest ruling, you need to honor it. And it's worth noting that the Attorney General has sent a letter to the hospitals earlier this month saying we will honor this new legal ruling. And hospitals use that letter to determine how much they paid in taxes to the state. And so now they're saying we relied on this letter to pay more in taxes because we assumed we were going to get more back because of this court settlement. And now you're telling us that you're going to put it into escrow. So it was, to put it lightly, a very heated and emotional hearing. Two sides that have been on opposite ends for years.
And we are focusing on the May 31st deadline, but this actually extends into next year as well, right? Mm-hmm. This applies?
Yes.
That the state's going to owe more money next year
Yes. So they under-budgeted by about $38 million in both years. And I think the thinking is, so obviously the May 31st deadline is the most pressing, but the thinking is that there might be some resolution. Lawmakers are and hospitals are hoping to find some sort of, negotiation, and if they negotiated on the side and found a settlement, this could all go away. Mm-hmm. But so far, tempers have risen, and this has been building up for years, and it doesn't seem like there's any kind of reconciliation on the horizon.
Well, one thing Morris has pointed out, and we should remember, this affects all states, and it affects the federal government. And it's Morris's view that the Trump administration may support a proposal in Congress that would, if all the court's appeals fail, the Congress could well change the rules and prevent the hospital from getting all this extra money.
Yeah. A few more stories to discuss this week. A lot of them have to do with opioid use and opioid deaths. Everyone was hoping to see sort of a drop in the number of opioid deaths in the state, but it turns out we've already come close to the number in 2017 than we had in the previous year. And the state has not done counting because the medical examiner's office is still processing cases from last year. Dean, what can you make of these numbers?
There had been some hope that, given all the efforts that we're seeing statewide and bringing in more federal dollars, that that the number would start to decline. And over the course of this year, there had been hope that the 2017 numbers would be lower than they are. Right now, where we are for 2017, 483 drug overdose deaths, which is only two fewer than 2016. And as you mentioned, there are still more under review. Most of them, not surprisingly, are linked to fentanyl. Actually, only one is from a pure heroin overdose. So the fentanyl, I think something like 350 out of the 483 have been fentanyl linked. So fentanyl continues to be an ongoing concern. As we saw this week, there was a huge fentanyl bust involving Lawrence, Massachusetts, and a drug ring. And so the war against fentanyl continues. 2018 so far, 40 people linked to drug overdose deaths, 86 still under review. So we'll see what 2018 brings.
And NHPR's Casey McDermott made the point that only one case of a death of heroin. This is often referred to as the opioid and heroin epidemic, but it may need to be renamed because it's the shifts you can kind of track the data, the shifts in how much fentanyl has just infused itself into these death statistics and into New Hampshire in general have been enormous.
And fentanyl is a powerful opioid, sometimes used for back injuries and things like that. So it really is an opioid crisis.
People suffering from cancer use fentanyl because it's intense pain. Worth noting, too, that there were reports this week that New Hampshire, between the years of 2016-2017, saw a 15% drop in the number of opioid prescriptions doled out, which was the largest drop percentage-wise anywhere in the country. I mean, it's hard to sort of draw a connection between the two, but it's hard to it seems germane, but I'm not sure how, I guess I should say. Because that's part of the effort, right, to make sure that
you
there are fewer—
that a drop in that drop would result in fewer deaths. We're also seeing now Concord and Dover are joining Manchester, Keene, and Nashua and suing drug companies for marketing practices. That's something that's been going on nationwide as well. So it is a multi-front battle, but unfortunately we're still seeing high numbers of overdoses.
It speaks to, I mean, this crisis has obviously, it took a few years, but it has now latched into the public consciousness in all kinds of levels, particularly if you talk to the medical community. You know, many more of them are aware of the dangers of overprescription, and New Hampshire has passed some changes to the prescribing rules. So you see that on that side, but the fentanyl problem still persists. So while, you know, the opioid use is less of a threat, the bigger problem is not resolved.
Well, gentlemen, I really wanted to end the show on a lighter note, like an animal story or something. Chickens wandering into someone else's yard. That's the way to end the show. But unfortunately, we don't have that this week. But you guys brought so much information and knowledge into the table today. Thank you very much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you.
It's Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader, Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website NH Political Capital. You can find links to all the stories we discussed today at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.